Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Oren Hoffman. Oren is a prolific entrepreneur and investor, having started and sold LiveRamp and invested in Thumbtack, Brightroll, and many more. This is a fascinating episode where we get into a lot. The concept of who you know versus what you know, preserving optionality regarding career, competing with computers, the future of college, how to pick a life partner, how to hire good people, how to give valuable feedback, navigating acquisitions, and much, much more. Oren has a lot of fascinating things to say. If you like what you hear, tweet at Oren, let him know, and check him out on Quora. All right, here's Oren. Welcome to Product Hunt Live.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure to have you here. So there's a ton we want to get into, you know, as it relates to a career, as it relates to broader intellectual questions, life advice. But first, I want to start with just a little quick intro background. When you talk to people at dinner parties and they ask you, and you have, you host awesome dinner parties, Oren. When people ask you, what do you do?
What do I do? Usually just say what company I'm involved with or something like that.
And did you know, that you were obviously, LiveRamp CEO, you obviously been involved in a bunch of different companies. Did you know, when you were in high school, when you were in college?
I was an entrepreneur in high school. That's how I paid my way through my college. And then I ran out of money after my third year of college. And so I had to start another business to pay for my fourth year of college. So I didn't always know I was going to be an entrepreneur, but I was always fairly entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm. And as you've kind of, sought out your path from a high level, how have you determined what success means?
I think success to me means like changing the world for the better. And trying to impact as many people as possible, ideally like in the billions of people that if you can make their lives better. I think obviously if you have set that bar that high, it's incredibly hard to be successful. So if you set that bar that high, like very few people are incredibly successful. But if you don't set that bar that high, then maybe you never strive and you never really reach your full potential.
And what inspired you to set the bar so high? Was it someone, a hero you saw? Was it a certain religious belief? Was it an intellectual? Who did you admire growing up?
I mean, there's always been a lot of people I admire, often admired many other entrepreneurs. I admire a lot of political entrepreneurs. So, when I was younger, I read a lot about political entrepreneurs, whether it be like Alexander Hamilton or Martin Luther King. Churchill was very much of a political entrepreneur. Spent a lot of time reading about those, read a lot of biographies.
It's interesting. One thing I've always, admired about your career is that you both have this concept of who you know and what you know.
Well, there's been this phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I think, first of all, like if we go back like 1,000 years, what you know was way more important than who you know. And just to survive, you had to do all these different things. So the what you knows were really important. You had to know how to farm. You had to do all these different things, and you had to knew how to kill your animals to eat, and you had to know how to defend yourself. And there was an incredible number of things that you knew that you had to know how to do. And so the what you knows were very, very valuable. And then maybe the last 100 years. You saw, maybe a little bit longer than that, you saw an ascendancy of the who you knows. And these who you knows were essentially people in the middle that would build relationships between the what you knows. Okay, you know this, you need to know something else over here, and I'm going to broker that transaction. And they tend to be brokers. So they tend to be the real estate brokers, the investment bankers, the corporate lawyers, et cetera, that were making these transactions fluid and doing that. And those were very, very important professions. And I think that probably peaked in the 1980s. And today, while the what the who you knows are very, very important, and knowing people is incredibly important thing. The what you know is more of an ascendancy, and I think that's because it's much easier to find the who you knows. There's LinkedIn, there's many of these other things. So it's more easy to find the what you know. So the who you knows that sit in the middle and that take a little vig in the transaction are less important today than they were in the past. They're still important, but less than they were in the past.
And is that trend only accelerating?
Yeah, I think it's still important. The who you knows is still really important, and I wouldn't say you should like not know anybody. I think that's still an important thing, but I think it's more important today the what you knows than it was 20 years ago. And my guess is it will probably be more important 20 years than it is today.
And when you say what you knows, are you talking about specialists, or do you also include generalists there?
Yeah, I think it can be a specialist or a generalist. So having some sort of proprietary knowledge, understanding the way the world works differently than other people do, being able to explain that and teach people about different incredibly hard concepts, this would be what a what you know is.
So given that concept, take me through, let's just say, imagine, someone just graduated college, they're 22, 23, big ambitions, share your ambitions. How should they best prepare?
Well, I think in their case, they should be looking at doing things that computers are not very good at. And so I think if you had thought of what was the best thing to do in the last 100 years, probably like the best predictor of becoming incredibly successful is to have a very high score on the SAT test. And to me, that is the thing that the computers are going to be most good at, is scoring really well on the SAT test. So I think that is probably not a good thing to optimize for, is to have very high SAT tests in the future. I think that was good in the past. And that all the best jobs, whether it be lawyers or engineers, et cetera, kind of like were around these linear thinking that the SATs were very good at looking at. And I don't think it will be, I think it will still be important to have a minimum bar on the SAT test. But today, I think if you don't score over 1500, it would be like incredibly difficult to get into Harvard. I think it would be really unwise to even think about Harvard if you probably don't score over 1500. I don't know the stats, but my guess is that's probably right. If Harvard is going to be Harvard 20 years from now, I don't think that will be the case. I think there'll be a certain bar, let's say a 1200, where it's still really important to get over. But there'll be many, many other factors that things people will be optimizing for. Because we're not just going to be competing with computers in the future, we're going to be working together with them, and we're going to be creating things, and there's going to be a lot of creativity and other types of things that are going to be really important.
Give me some examples. Like what can we get better at that computers just can't do?
Well, I don't know what computers will or will not do in the future, and I think that's really the hard thing is to predict what that is going to be. But there are certain things that, like, computers are going to be great at. And if you are just great at those things that computers are going to be great at, that doesn't seem to be a good strategy. So I can pretty much guarantee you that that it's very easy for a computer to score 1600 on an SAT. And so if your goal is optimizing that just seems like a really bad strategy. Now, there's a lot of other things that I don't know if computers are going to be good at or not. And there's some things that we're pretty confident that computers won't be good at for a long time. And so you probably want to be optimizing in a way that either at least that you don't know, or where you're pretty confident that it'll take a while for computers to be good at. Now, it's very hard to predict the future, so you might be wrong. But it's better than doing something that computers are going to be good at. That seems like a very, very risky strategy.
Is it maybe some of the softer skills, maybe sales, or maybe, some sort of creative or empathetic, maybe computers aren't going to be nurses or something,
Yeah, I don't. So probably you're right. Probably creativity, things like focusing on doing things that require a lot of creativity is really important. just being a creative person. I'm thinking about things in a different way. The SAT test does not test creativity at all. It is testing really nothing to do with creativity. And creativity has always been important to get ahead, and it's been always been important to be wildly successful. But in a world where computers can do a lot of the linear thinking, the creative people will become really important. Probably another thing that's going to be really important is being able to work well with computers. And so I think a lot of really talented people don't work well with computers. They second guess the computer. Like the best doctor may not be working well with the computer. They may be second guessing the advice that the computer gives them. So being able to work well with computers is going to be a really important skill set. If I was going to college, if I was giving advice to someone going to college today and a college major, I'd probably maybe suggest something like philosophy. It teaches you to think in many, many different ways. I was an engineer, and for people of my era, that was an incredibly good choice to go into. But it still probably is a good choice. But something like philosophy might be something really good. I wouldn't suggest people do like accounting. I think that's pretty risky to do. Unless you're going to be one of the very top accountants. So I think it's always going to be great to be in the top people. But if you don't believe you're going to be in the top realm, that seems like a very risky thing. If you're going to be a doctor, like maybe you probably shouldn't be in radiology. That seems like something computers are probably going to be pretty good at. So understanding where computers are going to be is going to be really important as to how you pick your career. People should affirmatively choose to go to college. I think today most people make the default decision for most people who go to college is that they go to college. And I think in general in society, we have too many default decisions that never get questioned. I still think it's the right choice for most people who go to college to go to college. And I don't think like all these people who go to college shouldn't go to college, but I do think people should think about it before they do it. And they might not, first of all, they should think about it, and they should think about when they should do it. They might not, maybe it's not the best thing to do right when they're 18. Maybe they should take some time off before they go to college. I think a lot of people would benefit from that before they did that. And where they went to college shouldn't necessarily be the default. What type of college program they go to shouldn't necessarily be the default. And then for some people, the fact that they go to college at all shouldn't necessarily be the default. These are things that one should question. This is a significant amount of time, a significant amount of cost that somebody's doing. It's not like what restaurant am I going tonight, which isn't really something you should really spend a lot of time thinking about. But a lot of people spend more time thinking about what restaurant they should go than like should I go to college or not, which is probably more important. I think a lot of these default questions in society are ones that people should be thinking about in general. So, for instance, I think the default today is if you get married, the default is that you have kids. I think the default should be to choose to have kids. Right now, the people who are married and don't have kids, they're the ones making the choice to not have kids. Now I have kids. I think it's a really wonderful thing to do for me, but it might not be the right choice for everybody. And I think people should think about it before they go do it, rather than it's the default decision to go do it.
There's so many things I'm curious about here. One, starting about let's go with kids, because I've never sort of had this urge to have kids yet, and I'm curious when you were younger, did you know you were going to have kids, or did someday you just kind of said, hey, I really want to have kids?
No, I personally was probably like over logical about it. And I thought about it a lot. Should I have kids? Should I not have kids? Et cetera. And for a while I wasn't sure. And then I kind of like you know, I kind of thought about it all really hard. And this is a massive, massive decision that someone's going to make. It's way more bigger decision than going to college or something. You know, so it's a incredible decision. And once you do it, you cannot, you know, my belief is once you do it, you cannot take it back. If you're going to have kids, you better darn well do a great job. And you really should make sure you're taking someone's life in their hands. And so it is, should not be something people take lightly, and you should give it a lot of thought.
Yeah. And, you have kids, are they going, do you think that they're going to go to college, you know, in a similar way that we went to college, or, you know, something that looks like a Stanford or a Harvard, or is the university structure going to change?
I hope there's more variety of higher education than there is today. Today, it seems like most of the well-known universities look very similar to one another. In fact, there's often very little difference between the top universities. But then you see people who leave university, and obviously learning continues, and then you see massive divergence of how people learn and how people think about it and how they find new things and how they find like-minded people to talk about stuff. And so the post-university learning to me is incredible. Like the way you learn and the way I learn is probably very, very different. And the way many, many other people learn is very different. And then we learn from each other about how to learn. And that's really, really interesting. I would like to see colleges look, you know, they don't have to be, there shouldn't be necessarily an infinite number of different learning styles, but having more than one seems like it would be really beneficial to society.
Yeah. And your daughter is in middle school right now?
My daughter is not even four, so.
Oh, why did I think she was a lot older? Okay, let's just say she was in, you know, middle school, and your middle school teacher, you know, the principal came to you and said, hey, we're starting over from scratch, like, you know, forget everything, and we want to hand you the reins to sort of advise us on what these, you know, 10 to 15 year olds should be doing all day. How would you think about designing a sort of learning curriculum?
It's a good question. I probably haven't given that enough thought. I mean, what I said earlier about competing with computers, I think, is really important. At some point in middle school, if I think back to my own schooling, and I'm trying to remember here because it was a while ago, at some point, the amount of creative things that one does in school goes down dramatically. And when I look at what my daughter does now in school, it is mostly focused on the creative. And then it seems like every year people spend less and less time doing creative things. Right now they're finger painting and they're exploring and they're building sculptures and they're singing and they're doing all these other types of things. And then at some point, and I don't know if that happens, you know, by middle school, but it goes down dramatically. And then there's like one creative class that you have, right? And everything else is this kind of rote type of thing. There might be some creative things that go on within the classes. Sometimes if you have a good, really good teacher, they'll teach math with a creative way, or they'll teach history and you'll dress up and you'll debate about the Constitution or something like that. And I think so hopefully these things will be more focused on the creative side, less on the rote side. And if you think about your experiences when you were growing up learning, probably the ones you remember the most are the ones where you had this like incredible teacher where they brought creativity into the learning environment. You know, like I remember debating the Constitution with my fellow kids in probably seventh or eighth grade, and I had to like dress up as Ben Franklin, and I had to, you know, give the position as Ben Franklin, and it was an incredible experience. I learned so much more from that than I could have by like watching some, you know, film or reading a book or, you know, whatever else it might be. So engaging in some sort of creative way is something that's probably good. And then that is something, again, that is probably less likely to be impacted by machines.
Yeah, no, good point. I want to get into some specific career questions. First off, You know, some people consider optionality as freedom. David Brooks in The Road to Character has the opposite viewpoint. He says it's the something like it's the things that you chain yourself that set you free. You know, once you commit to something, you're no longer stressing about it. You know, about all you know the paradox of choice or.
I think that's really interesting. Yeah, that's a great. I read that book, that the David Brooks book. I love that book. I mean, if you think of in life, the thing that is probably for most people the most important thing that they do, and also the thing that could have the most, at least for me, has the most fulfillment in life is marriage. And marriage is the ultimate elimination of options. It's an incredibly scary thing to do, and you need to have an incredible conviction to say, like, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with this person, right? And, you know, not all marriages work out, but when they do, it's just an incredible thing. And you need to believe, you can't A/B test that all the way through the rest of your life.
But it's interesting because marriage was designed, if I understand it correctly, in a world where we didn't live to be as long. Certain norms were different, obviously, in terms of relationships, in terms of sex. Do you think that marriage as it currently stands is going to continue to stand as is, or is going, you know, some people think there's going to be radical transformations in it. Technology has already changed how, you know, humans connect, romantically and sexually.
I think like kids, it's not for everybody. And I think it shouldn't be the default thing to go do. I think if one does do it, they should do it for the right reasons, and they should ensure that they get a lot out of it. And they shouldn't do it because there's societal reasons to do it, or there's pressure to do it, or, they're just that age, or, you know, whatever. There's lots of people who end up getting married for the wrong reasons. But if you do it for the right reasons, it's incredibly powerful. It's kind of like these deep friendships where you have these repeated conversations over and over. You mentioned, you know, whether it's Ben Casnoga or other people, where you probably are having these deep conversations over and over and over with people. That's an incredible experience to have, and it's very hard to do without spending a lot of time with somebody, and where somebody really gets to know you. And when people say, like, I love my spouse more than I did when I met them, you know, 40 years ago or whatever else it might be, it's usually true. It's that, you know, Well, I think it's because you're building these experiences upon each other. You're working together. You've built this life together, et cetera. And in fact, you're usually more compatible after 40 years together than you were prior to 40 years, right? You've grown up together. You've done all these things together, and so, you know, it's an incredible. Now, not to say that there isn't other ways of doing that beside marriage. Right now marriage is between two people, and, you know, I guess you can imagine marriages between more than two or some other types of things. And I think there might be other things that could be good for certain people. But I do think that marriage is a great institution. It just people should go into it with their eyes open. And if you're going to eliminate your options, you need to have a core thesis about it, and you need to have a strategy about it.
Let's stick on life partner concept for a second. If people accept the premise that they want one, how should one go about choosing?
I think like a lot of people create these lists of all the criteria that they want, and I think those are important, and you should have some sort of understanding of what you want. But to me, the most important thing on the list is the thing that people always forget to put on the list, which is that they need to find somebody who really likes them, and is really in love with them, and really who they are, and not who they are pretending to be. Because eventually, if you spend 40 years with somebody, they're going to figure out who you are, right? And so I think, to me, a better strategy when you meet somebody is to very quickly let them know who you are. What I might think is a plus in you, Eric, somebody else might find a minus in you, right? So I might love the fact that you're literary and you're really interested in stuff, and somebody else might see that as a minus. And what someone else might see a plus in you, because, you know, you're really into basketball and, you know, et cetera, or you're really into music lyrics, I might see as a minus. But to me, it's about being almost the better strategy is to quickly be honest about who you are, to let them know what's going on, and then for someone to kind of opt in to that. And a lot of the advice out there, it's like you should trick somebody into liking you. Yeah, and it just seems like an incredibly bad strategy.
Okay, so back to some of these business questions. Now, you've run a bunch of companies, you've sold a bunch of companies. What's something that you've changed your mind about recently?
A few things I've thought about recently that I think I would do differently. The first one, Henry Ward, who's the CEO of eShares, I've actually never met him, but he wrote this great piece on Medium called How to Hire, which I think is really, really interesting. And he had this really great thought about these false positives versus false negatives. And most startups, most companies are just incredibly worried about the false positive. You hire someone that turns out to be bad. And what they don't think about enough, according to him, and I'm starting to agree with him, is this great person that you didn't hire. Super talented person. You know, remember, one of the founders of WhatsApp, before he started WhatsApp, applied to a job at Facebook and didn't get it. He's probably someone they should have hired. And that might have been an incredibly expensive mistake to not hire that person. So I think the reason that happens is because if you're like six people, the false positive is so destructive to your company that hiring somebody bad is just a really, really can be a really, really bad thing that happens to your company. I think when you're like 200 people, and you hire like some, you know, junior software engineer or, you know, entry-level salesperson that doesn't work out, it's not nearly as destructive to your company. You give them a good severance package, you say, look, we made a mistake, et cetera. And as long as you're willing to admit that mistake quickly and rectify that mistake quickly, then moving at some point from erring totally to not having false positives to moving very quickly to the other side to not having false negatives. Not having false negatives is potentially a better strategy, and one that I hadn't really thought about before.
And let's talk about when you said admitting when they're not working out. Let's say they're working out from a productive standpoint, but not from a culture standpoint. So one, how do you know that that's happening? And two, your broader question, how should companies think about culture just in general?
Well, I think if they're adding ton of value to the company, if they're being productive, adding a ton of value to the company, and they're worth at least, you know, 2 to 3x what you pay them, in terms of adding to the company's value, then you should always keep that person. I think the problem is people don't do the calculus in the right way. So if someone's a jerk, they might be productive, but they might be dampening the people around them's productivity. And so then actually they could be a net negative to the company, or at least not enough of a positive to keep that person around. And so if when someone's a hindrance to the culture, it's often potentially because they could be making other people less productive. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you should get rid of that person. Maybe the culture is bad. Maybe there's something, maybe they're causing some problems within the culture because there's something wrong with the culture. Maybe the other people that they're dampening down are the people who should go. So just because this person is the one causing problems, because maybe this person just wants to move so much faster than everybody else wants to move. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing. You have to go figure that out. It doesn't necessarily mean some people are just jerks and they shouldn't be around. But often sometimes it's more, when it comes to culture, it's sometimes a little bit more complicated than that.
And broadly, what's your philosophy behind, building culture, in your startups?
Well, I think the word culture is to me very important to define. And it should be something, if you think about a company culture, it should be company that your company does that other companies like you don't do. So it almost can be defined as like how we're different. And so like, I think if you're in Silicon Valley and, you know, you don't have a dress code, you have free snacks, you have ping pong, everybody uses a Mac, that is not part of your culture because everybody else has that. Now, if you're in Silicon Valley and you have vending machines and everybody wears ties and, you know, you have windows, that is part of your culture. So I think it's really about how you're different than everybody else. And and when you are a company, you don't need to recruit everyone in the world. You know, if you can appeal just to 1% of the population to come work for you, that is, as long as it's, you know, there are super talented people in that 1%, that's good enough. And so, you know, if a Silicon Valley company like we wear ties and we're going to like have super clean desks and we're not going to have an open environment and whatever, like, I might not want to work there, but I bet you it could be a really successful type of company because they can get enough people, maybe a very, very tiny minority of people, but enough people that would really like love to work and they would like opt to work in this type of place rather than some other type of place.
So having an edge where people either love it or they hate it.
Yeah, culture should be something a lot of people should not want to work in that place. You know, that is culture. If everybody thinks this is great, then you're building something that is like, you know, is like vanilla ice cream. Everyone likes it, but it's no one's favorite.
Yeah, no, I just had a friend in from Bridgewater, the hedge fund in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Notorious for having sort of a place that absolutely repels people, but absolutely,
that's, you know, right.
Exactly.
I mean, Bridgewater is, and the Bridgewater PDF that explains their culture, in my opinion, should be required reading, not because you want to work in this place or you think this is the great, because it is so specifically defined as to what the Bridgewater culture is. And at the end of it, you're either like, I love it or I absolutely hate it. There's almost no in between. At the end of reading that, and at the end of that reading that PDF, and I think that's great. And I think they have an incredibly strong culture, and it's worked out really well for them.
Okay, so let's talk about hiring. What's better, hiring sort of all around athletes or, you know, set position players?
Well, I think if you know exactly what you're going to do, or maybe not exactly, but if you have a really good understanding of what you're going to do, hiring position players is better. And so if you like, you know you're building a world-class football team, you need to hire that great kicker who can kick that field goal perfectly. Because you know that's going to be a really important piece of the game, and you pretty much know you can't win a championship unless you have that great kicker. Now that great kicker is going to be really expensive because they're very specialized. So they're one of the very best in the world at what they do. And so hiring that person is going to be really good. Now, if you don't know what sport you're going to be playing, and you have no idea, you know, if you're going to, you know, all of a sudden, if you're going to be, you know, competing in the decathlon or something like that, hiring that specialized kicker who only kicks those field goals super straight and accurate is a very bad strategy. And so for most startups, I would opt for going for the all-around athlete. And for most areas of the company, I would opt for going for the all-around athlete until you know exactly in this particular area for this particular company, and that that this is going to stay the same for a long time, and then we can hire the position player.
Earlier, I asked you, before this interview, offline, I was asking you what's something you used to believe that you changed your mind on, and you wrote team versus collection of individuals.
I think I used to think that companies were more like basketball, where team is really important, but the core collection of individual talent probably outweighed the team play in many ways. And so it's like if you have like LeBron James on your team, you're like really likely to win most games. In fact, if we took LeBron James off of the Cavaliers right now and we moved him to the worst team in the league next year, that team almost certainly will get into the playoffs. Just with the fact that they had the addition of the best player, you know, in the world. But I don't think it's that way. I think it turns out that the best collection of players doesn't always win in companies, and the way these people interact and how the team works is really, really important. And thinking about the team, you still want a lot of talented people. And so you don't want to take away from the talent, but you can win with slightly less talented people a lot more often if you have the right team dynamic.
So what's your sort of litmus test for when you're evaluating a founding team?
Well, that I think you don't have much data because you know, there might be like two guys or something, and often it's pretty easy for two people to work really well together. I don't think you have a ton of data about how they can build, unless they've built some sort of a successful team before. I think it's sometimes this is, you know, this is hard to do. It is hard to, you know, when you make an investment, I think just at least understanding the talent level of the people that you're investing in is an incredibly important, criteria before making an investment.
Like if the WhatsApp founder came to you and you were at Facebook, you know, how would you have noticed?
I don't know. I may not have. I probably made so many errors. I probably, you know, and I'm publicly apologizing right now to anyone I've never, didn't give a job to, because there's probably all these amazing, talented people that I passed on because I just didn't know. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't evaluate it. In fact, some of the most amazing people might be the highest beta. So they might be the hardest ones to figure out in some sort of environment. The interview is not the best way to evaluate talent.
What's a better way?
Yeah. And then of course, you know, the problem is you need some sort of gate because you can't work with everybody, right? And so it is incredibly difficult and very humbling to go through be a hiring manager. It is something where you just quickly realize you do not have the answers and you're not nearly as smart as you may have thought you were.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about feedback, you know, positive feedback versus constructive feedback.
Well, this is something this is probably the other core thing I've changed my mind on very recently. I think like many people, especially people who are high achieving people, I always had thought constructive feedback is better, and I always liked it better when people gave me constructive feedback on how I can improve on something. You know, constructive feedback is, you know, you're batting, you're taking a swing, and the coach is, oh, you know, if you just change your grip a little bit like this, you just do a little bit like this, then you can swing it better. And for me, that was always great. You don't have to scream at me. Constructive isn't screaming. You know, it's critical, but it's pointing out some sort of flaw and giving me some sort of help on how to make that flaw less of a flaw or make it better. Positive feedback, the reason why I think in the past I thought positive feedback was not as good as constructive feedback is I think most people, including myself in the past, didn't give positive feedback well. So like most good managers, I always knew you had to give a lot of positive feedback, and they always say like three parts positive for every one part constructive, or you know, whatever else, or there's some sort of ratio that you have to give. But like most people in the past, the way I give positive feedback was, hey, you did a really good job on that presentation. Or great work, or great sale, or oh, thanks for getting it done on time, or even before time, or, you know, wow, this looks really good. And that's nice. Certainly to hear that is a nice thing for people. But I think real positive feedback is a good positive feedback, if you're a really good manager, is when you say something very specific. Okay, you know in that sales presentation when you started with this slide rather than this one and you did this transition over here and whatever, like that was so good because it got them engaged in a way that you wouldn't have expected, and it created a dynamic like this, and now you're really getting into it with them. And the reason why that's so good is because they may have not known that that was good. they may have, right? And so you're working with them to go do that. And I've kind of changed my philosophy recently. About a year ago, I started, I'm not most athletically gifted guy, and I started taking tennis lessons. And I have this incredibly positive coach, the most positive person I've ever met. And the first time I played with him, I probably had like one out of 100 forehands were good, and the rest of them were just like absolutely awful. And what he would do is he would stop play when you accidentally had this great forehand. He would stop play, and you'd come to the net, and then he would talk about, you know how you turned your body like this, and you pushed off with your leg, and you did this, and you kind of ended up like, and he would explain, and of course I didn't know any of this. Like I just kind of like accidentally had but he would walk me through why it was good. And then his whole core thesis is he stopped play when you did something good, not when you did something bad. So your muscle memory would remember the good thing that you did, and that you would, and then you're more like, and then instead of doing 1 out of 100, and then maybe do 2 out of 100, and then 5 out of 100, and then et cetera, and you get better and better and better at that. I think it's much harder to give good positive feedback, which is why almost nobody does it. But for me, what I would like to do differently in the future is focus on that more and give more of that when we're with people, which is harder. So it puts more of a burden on me as a manager, and then also work with others in the organization to help them give other people positive feedback.
What about on the flip side of that? Negative feedback when people aren't performing but they can be.
Well, I think it's, you know, having these conversations is really important. So I mean, constructive conversations, so it kind of like there's kind of two feedbacks, constructive feedback and positive feedback, and having conversations with people about, you know, it's not like my coach never tells me what I'm doing wrong. He does, but he spends a lot more time dissecting what I'm doing well and encouraging me to do more of that. For certain people, especially, I think, you know, especially once you're over a certain age, it's really hard to change your personality. So if it's like, hey, you need to be, you know, more outgoing, and you know, you need to, you know, it's like, well, like, okay, well, like, that's going to be a hard personality thing to change. Let's focus on like what people do really well, and let's get them even better at some of those things. And people can't be great at everything. In fact, it's incredibly difficult to be great at one thing. And so asking people to be great at more than one thing, you have a few people that might be great at 2 or 3 things. There's almost no one that's great at more than 2 or 3 things. And getting to great is way better than getting to good. So you want to help the people you're with to get to great. And I'll never be a great tennis player, so that will never happen. I'm not athletic. I don't have the athletic ability to do that, and so I'm playing for fun. But I still can get way better than I am now.
I had the same conclusion about my basketball skills, but it took me like 10 years. a lot of basketball camps to realize that. We make our other successes in life. Speaking of. How should companies think about selling their companies? How should they think about acquisitions? Should they think about acquisitions?
I think companies shouldn't be designed to be acquired, but at some point, you know, a lot of companies do get acquired. And I think the way to best optimize the acquisition process is to think about it from the lens of the acquirer as to and try to figure out how to give the acquirer the most value. And I think for most acquirers, when they're thinking about acquiring a company, there's so many risks involved, because you know probably 80% of acquisitions don't work. They have negative value, and they know that. And there's risks with the talent, and there's risks with the technology, and there's risks with the market, and will these things, these two cultures, are they going to be able to mesh together and work together? And you know, certain companies might be able to acquire companies better than others, certain companies better than others. And so by putting yourself in their shoes and figuring out, okay, how will this acquisition be successful post-acquisition, I think is the best way to ultimately have a good acquisition. We got acquired at LiveRamp by a company called Axiom. This was, you know, I think hands down one of the best acquisitions in the tech sector in the last 10 years. It worked out really well for the acquirer. We got acquired about 19 months ago. The value of LiveRamp as a company has gone up dramatically since then. And I think that's because a lot of thought was put in to how it would work together post-acquisition, well before we actually went down the acquisition process.
How do you balance the tension between focus and diversity? And I know it's something, you know, we've talked about in both experience, in that, you know, focus is super important, but diversity is super interesting. And so how do you either have both in your life or certain times for focus, certain times for diversity?
Well, I think it's a huge struggle. And it should be a struggle for most smart people. It is really hard to figure out what you should focus on. For instance, like making that bet for LiveRamp was a very, very big bet, which could have turned out really badly. I think it would, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to say, okay, this was the right bet. But while you're in the middle of the bet, it's very hard to know that is the right bet to make. And I think that is what people are doing in their career all the time. They're making a focused bet somewhere, which might turn out to be wrong. Computers might be able to do it, or there might be tons of other competition in that particular area. You're going after some sort of market, and like, you know, it's like you think this certain sport's going to be big, and you know, everyone's going to be doing this sport, and everyone's going to be watching the sport. So I'm going to focus on being really good at the sport. It turns out like 80 million other people start focusing on the sport as well, and you know, like, it just, you have all this competition. It's really hard to go do that. It's really, really hard, and this tension is probably going to exist for most people for the rest of their life.
I want to ask a question about, you know, you invested in over 70 companies, and over the past 20 years, you've seen a ton of successful founders. Now, set up this example just to make a point. I have a friend who wanted to start a fund around sort of, you know, great founders, but also them living healthy and happy lives. And I almost thought that this might be like an adverse selection bias for the people. Like, what do you think about this? You know, what traits, common trends have you found in this process?
Well, I think there's very few commonalities amongst great founders. I think there are tall founders and short founders. I think there are thin founders and fat founders, smart founders and not so smart founders. There's ethical founders and there's unethical founders. Who've all been, you know, incredibly successful. And so I think if we like went through the list of like the top 1,000 traits, and scored all the, you know, let's say we scored the top 1,000 founders on the top 1,000 traits, there wouldn't be a lot of commonality amongst them there. So I think it's really, again, it's a humbling thing. It's why it's so hard to pick out. There's probably there's something with like perseverance or grit that's probably more common. Again, not with everybody, but it's, you know, if you can somehow know that would, you, I don't know how you would know that if you were evaluating somebody, but if you could somehow figure out that someone had perseverance or grit, if you could really figure out if they were really ambitious, this is probably something that could be really good. But in general, there's not a lot of commonality amongst great founders, or, you know, in some ways, great employees.
And so you invested in over 70 of them. Is it sort of a gut instinct on whether you think they'll be super ambitious or have the right perseverance, or are there certain litmus tests?
Well, first of all, none of your listeners should take advice from me on, you know, investing. That's not what I...
You've done well.
You know, I've done incredibly well, but I've also been like very active investor in the last 8 years. And if you were a very active investor in Silicon Valley the last 8 years, 100% of them did incredibly well. So it's just a very good time to be an investor. And it's not necessarily because I'm a good investor. And it's not something I focus on or think about a lot, and I don't think of myself as an investor in any type of way, or really focus on being a great investor. So I don't necessarily know. I generally think doing what I do, which is investing like an hour a week in startups, is like a very stupid thing to do, and that one should not do it. What if one is going to be an investor, one should be a focused investor. One should only do investing in startups. They should do it as their full-time job. And they should be thinking about it all the time, and they should be evaluating how to do it in the best way. And for someone like me, it's more like a fun thing that I do. And it's like, I play tennis, I invest in companies. And I feel like it's a nice way of giving back. I hope to make money, and I've been lucky enough to have done so, but it's not the thing that I would recommend people do.
Do you have thoughts on whether the 8 years was a great time to invest? Do you think the good days are over, so to speak? Do you think we're about to enter a new era?
I don't know, but what I do know is that the competition for investing has gone up dramatically. And so there's way more investors today than there was 8 years ago. There's way more money today going into investing than there was 8 years ago. And so if the number of companies continues to rise, the number of great investing opportunities continue to rise, and certainly the number of great opportunities has risen. So if it rises as a greater rate than the number of great investors and great money that's out there, then it will continue to be good. But it seems like the number of investors and the amount of money out there has risen faster than the amount of opportunity. If that goes down, which could be because of an economic shock, or could be for because it's not cool anymore to be investing. I think a large number of people who invest because it's cool, or there might be a lot of other reasons why it might go down. If that goes down, then it may again be a great time to be an investor. But now it's probably not as good of a time as it was 8 years ago to be an angel investor. Still might be good, but maybe not as
right.
good.
Yeah. And I want to ask a series of sort of broader questions. The famous Peter Thiel question, who you've worked with for many years. What do you believe that no one else believes?
I mean, maybe like another way to rephrase that, which is probably very similar to the Peter Thiel question, which is like, what is something you believe that's very unpopular? Which is really, I think, what he's getting at. To me, I basically think like, pretty much all luxury items like art, wine, jewelry, are marketing. And I think it's basically this like massively wonderful scam that we all buy into, and that we find like meaning and pleasure from in life. And I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing. I don't say scam in a bad way. I think it was kind of a good way that we all buy into these luxuries, and we think, and 100% of us, unless you're like the Unabomber, has bought in some sort of way into this marketing. And I don't think there's like, for most things in art, I don't think they're intrinsically better. I listened to one of your podcasts, I forgot which one, where he was basically saying like, okay, like people who do better in art is because they're intrinsically better than the other people. I don't believe that. I think they might be intrinsically better marketers. So they might actually be way better at marketing the product, but I think a huge amount of luxury items like that are based on marketing and not because they're intrinsically better. I basically hate every single No Doubt song every time I've ever heard it. I just think they're just terrible. And by like the 1,000th time I've heard it, I like the song. That song, like, it's all about the bass, no treble. Like, I think it's just the worst song ever written. And now I find myself like humming it to myself sometimes. And just because I've like heard it so many times.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Is there a concern that the people making the best art are not the best at marketing their art, and maybe their art doesn't get distributed, and in fact, shitty art gets distributed, or is that not?
No, I don't know. That's a good question.
And it's a broader philosophical question of who determines what's good, just the amount of people that like it, or you know?
Yeah, I mean, generally the way art is determined is good is that you think it's good because other people think it's good. And I know people don't want to believe that that's true and like, oh no, I'm not part of the scam. I make up my own mind about it. And I think there are probably a few people that do, you know, really make up their mind about something and they find something that really spoke to them or whatever. But like the vast majority of us think something is good because somebody else thinks it's good. I mean, it's like the Mona Lisa really the best ever because her eyes follow you wherever you go. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do I like the Mona Lisa? Yeah, I like it because everyone else likes it. And I've been taught to like it my whole life. And so, you know, like, I don't know if it's really the best piece ever made.
How do you in your own life determine, like, you know, really prioritize what's worth doing?
Well, that's kind of that whole goes back to that focus question. It's really, really, really hard. And you're never going to optimize that right. It's impossible to optimize it right. And so you have to be okay with being wrong, or being at least under optimized as to what you're going to do. You pick something, might not be the perfect thing, but you pick something. And hopefully you're on a track. You think about it a little bit, and hopefully you're on a track that makes sense. And you know, it's like you can't take every meeting with somebody who wants to meet with you, especially if you reach a certain level of success and you have lots of people that want to meet with you. You can't take every meeting, but there are certain meetings that you're not sure about that you did take, and they turned out to be extra special, and turned out to be this, you know, wonderful meeting. And that, you know, moved you onto a new path or really increased your learning or increased, you know, a really interesting opportunity or whatever it might be. So, you know, these are really hard things to figure out.
To close, you know, you've run a bunch of companies, sold a bunch of companies. You have optionality. you could be doing a bunch of different things, but, you've chosen to remain an operator. And with your goal of affecting, you know, a billion people, why operator over investor over, you know, anything else you could be doing? And how did you come to that, you know, conclusion?
Well, I think investors, like, well, especially like venture capitalists, I think that's an extremely important profession and really valued profession and a profession that I admire a lot. But I do think that it's important to understand like what you're good at and to play to your strengths. And, you know, it's not particularly something that I'm very good at. You know, I might be better at it than some, but I feel like I'm a better operator than I am an investor. I also enjoy it more. Maybe that's one of the reasons I'm a better operator than investor. I like being in the weeds. I like being in the detail stuff, you know, et cetera. So I think it's important to like play to your strengths. Part of the hard part of playing to your strengths is figuring out what your strengths are. And so one easier way to figure out what your strengths are is to almost sometimes figure out what they're not, and then to start eliminating things as to what they're not. And so I've consistently thought to myself, like, I should not become a venture capitalist. And that, you know, in some ways, this is, again, going against the default. Most successful people that have had, you know, they've had some sort of success in Silicon Valley, it seems like this is it's an area at least that they explore being a venture capitalist, and very few of them are willing to say, I do not want to be a venture capitalist. And I think it is by eliminating options is sometimes a good thing in your career to go do that.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect note to close on. So lastly, do you have any sort of plugs for the audience of things you have upcoming or ways people can learn more about you online? Or
well, yeah, I mean, one of the projects I'm working on right now is Siftery, as you know, Siftery launched on Product Hunt in January, a few weeks ago, and it was you know, incredibly successful launch on Product Hunt. Product Hunt was a great for us, at least. It was a really great medium to launch Siftery on. And for those, and Siftery is essentially a way for you to understand which software tools you and your company should look at and evaluate and buy. And for any of your listeners that haven't tried Siftery out yet, you know, I'd love for you to try it out and then send me your feedback on what we could do better.
Perfect. And I also want to stump for check out Oren on Quora, Oren Hoffman, and at Oren on Twitter. And he's got some fascinating answers on Quora. So definitely that is a good use time. Oren, this has been a pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you so much. A pleasure. And I know it's we've been looking forward to it for a while. Thank you for coming on Products Online.
Thank you very much, Eric. Really appreciate it.